following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
And historically, what have been the principles of hermeneutics down through the years? We looked at the Jewish methods of interpretation. Then we looked at some of the early and patristic citations. Then we looked at the Middle Ages and the Reformation last week. And now we're ready this week to look at some of the principles that developed in the post-Reformation period. And we're going to hopefully be able to get up through the 19th century before we get into that probably craziest of all centuries, our own, next Lord's Day. Illyricus, or Matthias Flaccius Illyricus, lived in 1520 to 1575. And in 1567, he published, this is my translation, it's actually Clavis Scripturae Sacrae. I translated a key to the Holy Bible. Would our Latinists agree with that? Clavis key, and then that would be dative singular. So we can't say scriptures; that would be plural. So we almost have to say Holy Bible, right? So key to the Holy Bible.
Of the Holy Bible.
Yeah, key. It could be of the Holy Bible or to the Holy Bible, genitive or dative. Right, it's first declension. So key to the Holy Bible. And basically what he promoted, and this is a key thing, in 1567, he's promoting trying to discern the author's intent. So, now granted, there are going to be various principles by which we might discern the author's intent, by which we might try to find out the author's intent, and that's one of the things that we're going to be studying. But it's important for us to understand that this is a significant break from the Middle Ages, because what is this saying now? That whatever the author intended is what it means. So how many meanings are there going to be?
One.
So if the author intended something in a literal way, how should it be taken? Literally. But if the author intended it symbolically, then how should it be taken? Symbolically. So we can't take a single passage of Scripture both literally and symbolically at the same time, because that would be destructive of the principle of author's intention or author's intent. Are you with me? You following? Okay. I have RCC responses to the Reformation. That's so that none of you will be upset with me for calling them papists. But that's who the RCC is. The RCC simply is a kind way of saying papist. Basically, how did they respond to the Reformation? What is the key documents, or the key document, or series of documents to the Reformation? What was the key document of the Counter-Reformation? The Council of Trent.
Yes.
The Tridentine principles, the Tridentine confession. Basically, what they set forth at that time, the Council of Trent, by the way, canonically or by way of church canon, by way of church law, added the Apocrypha for the first time. Now, granted, there had been Bibles published prior to that, the Latin Vulgate, the Old Septuagint, and so forth, had the Apocryphal books in them, but no council had ever said, here are the books of the Bible. No church council had ever said, here are the books of the Bible. The Council of Trent said, including the apocryphal books, they said, here are the books of the Bible. However, that's not what we're talking about right now. What we're referring to is hermeneutics. And in particular, it was the case that virtually all of the reformers, we spoke about Babylon a little bit in the Sacramento's worship service, with whom did the reformers virtually across the board equate Babylon?
Rome.
Exactly. The Roman Church. And in equating Babylon to the Roman Church, they also equated What biblical character? What biblical personage?
Antichrist.
They also equated pretty much across the board Antichrist or that man of sin in 2 Thessalonians. We'll look at Grotius in a moment and see the exception. But they pretty much across the board regarded the papacy as being Antichrist, Babylon, and so forth. Well, the Roman Catholic Church now is going to respond to that. And the way they're going to respond, of course, partially, is by way of simply authoritative decree. Oh, no, we're not. And the reason we know we're not is because we say we're not. Okay, so that's one way, just authoritative decree. But the other thing that they're going to do is they're going to respond with interpretations of the book of Revelation that are different from those of the Reformer, from that of the Reformers. Two men, Francesco de Ribera, who lived 1537 to 1591, and Luis de Alcazar, who lived 1554 to 1613, basically undertook the idea of refuting the Reformed identification of the papacy with the Antichrist and the apostasy of Revelation. Here's how they did that. They interpreted the book of Revelation differently than the Reformers had interpreted it. So that Ribera interpreted Revelation in a futurist way. Now, when I say futurist, not the first three books. The first three books he understood in a preterist way, just like virtually everyone understands the first three books of the Revelation the same way. The first three chapters, I'm sorry. The first three chapters of the Revelation are understood by virtually everyone in pretty much an historical manner, or a preterist manner, if you will. But what he did is he changed the interpretation or reinterpreted, however you want to say it, the interpretation of the Reformers such that from chapter 4 onward became futurist. He relegated it basically to the last 7 years of human history at some time in the future. That's De Ribera. De Alcazar interpreted the entirety of the book of Revelation in a preterist perspective. In other words, this all refers back to either Nero or to Gaius, one of the Roman emperors, and therefore, since it refers to them, who can't it be? Can't be the Pope. So both the futurist interpretation of Ribera and the preterist interpretation of Alcazar were designed initially to deflect the accusation that was being made by the Reformers that the Pope was Antichrist. Now, does that automatically make them wrong? Does that? Somebody sitting there. Does that automatically make them wrong? Doesn't automatically make them wrong, does it? But it's important. It's important as we deal with various interpretations to know what their source is. And that's the reason we're doing the historical study. Okay, next slide. I told you Grotius was coming up. Grotius was a judge or a Dutch jurist. Not jurist the way we use the word in this country, where a jurist is only one of 12 people who have been impaneled to sit on a jury. Not simply, he was a judge in Holland. And he also broke with identifying the papacy with Antichrist. He regarded 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, as the Emperor Gaius. Now, here's the key thing to Grotius. It's not whether or not he identified the Pope as that man of sin in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The key thing that he contributed from a Reformed perspective is the fact that we need to interpret a passage of Scripture in its historical context. We can't, for example, he would maintain, we can't go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and interpret it the way somebody would interpret it in 1645. We have to go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and interpret it the way it would be interpreted by the people to whom it was written. That's not an unreasonable addition. That's not an unreasonable thing to say. However, even when he was wrong, which I think he was in the case of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, that's an important concept. It's important for us to remember that we need to interpret a passage of Scripture in light of what the author intended to convey to the people to whom he was writing. And in order for us to know that, we have to situate a passage of Scripture in its historical context. We have to situate it contextually or co-textually in terms of what went before and what comes after, and we also have to interpret it historically, or we have to situate it historically in terms of why it was written. Okay? Some of you aren't taking notes. Some of you are simply making my notes yours. Maybe we should have handouts. Just all go home. Next slide. John Lightfoot. No applause? John Lightfoot. Do you all know who John Lightfoot was? John Lightfoot took up the cause of Erastianism at the Westminster Assembly. John Lightfoot was later made bishop of... I don't remember either. He later became known as Bishop Lightfoot. But he's not Bishop J.B. Lightfoot. We'll talk about him a little bit too. But John Lightfoot, here's his contribution to hermeneutics. It certainly isn't his understanding of Erastianism. Erastianism is a wrong-headed view of church government. Okay. For those of you who don't know what Erastianism is, let me suggest you go back and get out the biblical polity tapes and listen to them or watch them. But John Lightfoot was an Erastian, but his contribution was not in the area of Erastianism. His contribution was in the area of Hebraic studies. Basically, what he did was he went through several books of the Bible. He has it's four volumes called Horai Hebraicai et Talmudicai. It's basically a commentary on some of the books of the New Testament based on Jewish background studies. Or Hebraic and Talmudic background studies. It's back in print for those of you who care to have it. I was going to say serious students of the Bible. I shouldn't say serious because I hope you all are serious. But scientific students of the Bible really should have that set. It's four volumes. It's in print from Hendrickson. And it's relatively inexpensive. It's like $30 for the set or something like that. It adds much. Now, let me say this. If you're going to get it, don't bother if you don't have Hebrew first. Okay, you're going to have Hebrew first. Or just leave them on the shelf until you have Hebrew. Because, you know, when he quotes from the Talmud, when he quotes from the Hebraic background studies and so forth, he's quoting. And he also does not use points. So you're going to have to get used to the idea of reading Hebrew without your seminary points, without your vowel system. But if you can do that, it's very valuable. It gives an awful lot of insight. First of all, one of the volumes is just on place names. So it deals with various place names and geographical and background studies. Then one of them, then he does Matthew, Acts, and 1 Corinthians, I believe, are the three books that he does. There may be others that he does partially, but those are the three that he does completely. So it's very, very valuable. Basically, the idea that we need to remember is that the New Testament was written in a partially Greek atmosphere and a partially Hebrew atmosphere. I'm saying atmosphere in the sense of historical context. So if we want to understand when someone uses a certain phrase, for example, let me just give you a real quick example. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. And the reason that I'm bringing out 1 Corinthians 14 is simply because we're going to be there in our morning worship service next week. And so I happen to know what he says on 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 26. You see that phrase, how is it then, brethren? You see that phrase, how is it then, brethren? What he points out is that phrase is lifted from a Talmudic ruling. So that when Paul uses it, and remember, Paul's background is as a Talmud scholar or as a Hebrew scholar under Gamaliel. Remember that? So when he's using that, he's using it in a very similar way to the way the Talmud would use it. And basically what they're doing is, when the Talmud uses that phrase, they, first of all, bring forth the instances within a case, Then when they use this phrase, they say, and here's the ruling. Here's the way it comes out. Here's the outcome. Here's our decision. So when he says here, how is it then, brethren? He's going to go on and give what's going on first, the background first. Then he's going to give a ruling. And the ruling here is, let all things be done unto edifying. So he's going to give us a specific rule to follow in the context of Christian worship.
Does he give examples to prove his point?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, if you're willing to look up his examples in the folios of the Talmud, you'll find them.
Oh,
now, there is a copy of the Talmud down at the DTS library. But yes, he cites the folio pages and everything. Yeah. That's why you have to know the Hebrew. Yeah. That's right. You always have your dictionary. That's right. Get out your analytical lexicon. So John Lightfoot, very, very valuable contribution. Next slide. Back up just a little bit. John Mill. Now here with John Mill, what we're getting into is the area of text studies or text criticism or textual studies. And John Mill basically in the year 1707 published an edition of Erasmus' Greek New Testament. Remember Erasmus from last week or from last lecture? Erasmus published the Greek New Testament, basically made up of a collation of the manuscripts to which he had access. Well, John Mill in 1707 published an edition of Erasmus' Greek New Testament with an apparatus of approximately 30,000 variants. Now, what is an apparatus? Do you have a Greek New Testament with you? I don't have mine with me.
I don't have.
You don't have yours. Basically, what an David, you don't have one with an apparatus. Yeah, you've never used an apparatus in your life. Yeah, so if it ain't in the TR, I'm not interested in what it says anyway. But what an apparatus is at the bottom of the page or at the back of the New Testament, depending upon how it's set up, you'll have a particular portion of the verse. And let me give you an example. In Greek, the word for hour or hours is hamon. Okay? Did you all hear that? Hamon. The Greek word for your or yours is humon. Okay, basically we're talking about a letter difference. Okay, the aspiration is the same. The difference is the eta as the first letter versus the upsilon as the first letter. Okay, hamon versus humon. That's a very common variant. That's the reason I bring that one out. It's a whole bunch of them throughout the New Testament where one manuscript will have our faith, and another manuscript will have your faith.
It's not for us, it's a different language.
It's a different language. But basically, at the bottom of the page, then, what there will be is a list of these manuscripts have hamon, these other manuscripts have humon. That's an apparatus. Okay. In the particular apparatus that John Mill published in 1707, he listed about 30,000 variants in the New Testament. So interestingly, when you go to seminary or Bible college for that matter, they'll tell you that there are very few variants in the modern text versus the Textus Receptus. They'll say, oh, there are very few. Say 95% of it is the same. And yet what's hard is to find a page of the New Testament that does not have a variant on it. If you have a New Testament, I would recommend if you're going to get a Greek New Testament with a text apparatus in it, get UBS 4th edition. They've made it a little bit easier to read than the 3rd edition was. The 4th edition is actually a little bit easier to read. Yes.
I'm surprised you wouldn't recommend the majority text with apparatus.
If you can get majority text with apparatus, that's fine. What I use is not even the majority text. What I use when I'm reading and exegeting the Greek is the Scrivener TR from 1881.
Right. The majority text now is out with apparatus.
Yeah. But it also makes changes in the text. Right. I mean it differs. I shouldn't say makes changes. It differs in what they put in the text from the TR,
right,
from the Texas.
UBS poll.
Yes, yes. But the only reason, and again, I would not even recommend that you rush right out and buy one. I'll tell you why, because next year they'll have UBS 5. I've had the UBS 2, the second edition UBS, for 25 years. And the differences between it and the fourth edition are minimal. Very few differences. And I'm just not ready to go out and spend $30 for another New Testament. But what I want to point out here is the fact that starting about 1707, a new concept, a new key idea came into interpreting the text, and that is, which text are we interpreting? Okay, you see why that's an important question to ask? If you and I are going to the same verse and we're going to interpret it, and one of us has a text that says our faith, and the other person has a text that says your faith, we're going to interpret that verse differently, aren't we? I would hope we would. So that all I'm getting at is that John Mills and John Owen got very upset about this thing. And the reason he did was because he believed that by publishing the variants at the bottom of the same page as the New Testament text, is that basically what you were doing is you were bringing in doubt, that you were sowing the seeds of, yea, hath God said. And you know the old saw about the King James Bible. You know, it's mocking. But, you know, people will say, well, if it was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me. You know, and they say that in a mocking way. You know, the fact of it is, and you stop and think about it, when you look at the Protestant Reformation as being the greatest revival since the apostles, and every one of the reformers used the same Greek text, I think we have to have some pretty profound reasons for deviating from that text. As my good friend Wallace Bell says, the King James is the version God uses. And by that he means that God uses it in people's lives, and has for hundreds of years. Next slide. J.A. Bingle developed the rule, and here I'm going to butcher the Latin, Proclivi scriptioni praestet ardua. Basically, the hard reading is to be preferred to the easy reading. How's that for a translation? I'm looking over here to my Latinist. Maybe I should be looking back there. The hard reading is preferable or should be preferred to the easy reading or the easy writing. I guess writing rather than reading. But basically, here's the rule. Y'all understand that the manuscripts that we have are not the manuscripts that the apostles actually wrote. Did you all know that? Does this come as a surprise to you? Okay. That means that along the way, some people have made copies. What are called scribes or copyists have made copies of those manuscripts that were written either by the apostles or by their secretaries. The idea behind this rule, the idea behind Bingle's rule, is that if a copyist were going to change something, he would not change the reading to make it harder. He would change the reading to make it easier. Now, how do we know that? Yeah, it's a presupposition. The idea being, well, there are several suppositions that go before this one. You know, one is that the scribe understands what he's copying. The second is that he understands the language better than the person who wrote it, or the person whose copy he has. And then the third thing is that he's going to believe himself free to change it. How many of those things have been proven? They've all been assumed. Yeah, they've all been assumed. The fact of it is, as for all the things that are written, for all the things that are put out there about scribal transmission, we know next to nothing about scribal transmission. Probably the most difficult work, the greatest work that has been done in the area of scribal transmission has been done by, he's now passed away, I hope he's with the Lord, a man by the name of E.C. Colwell of the University of Chicago did some excellent work, particularly with respect to the papyri, which are some of the oldest. And basically what he did was, you know, in order to be able to tell what kind of an error a scribe will make, what do you have to have? Now think about this very carefully. Let's be detectives. If you're going to find out what kind of an error a scribe is going to make, you have to know what was his exemplar, and you have to know what copy he was working on, right? Okay, we have no certain knowledge, no absolute knowledge of any two manuscripts that bear that relationship. Well, if we can't even establish that much, then how can we establish what were common scribal errors? Now, there are other, we'll get into text criticism a little bit more in detail later on in the course, but basically what we have to do is be reasonable, be realistic, and not simply make rules that contradict one another. And by the way, many of the rules that we follow or should be followed or are set forth as normative in text criticism are contradictory. Let me give you an example. Let's take this. The hard reading is to be preferred to the easy reading. But there is another rule that says the short reading is to be preferred to the long reading. Well, now what happens when the short reading is the easy reading? Let me show you how you resolve that. Well, I can't. I don't have a coin. If I had a coin, I'd show you how to resolve that problem. Well, the fact of it is, it's perfectly subjective. The text critic does not approach his discipline empty-headed. And it would be wrong for him to do so. It would be wrong for any of us to approach our discipline, our calling, empty-headed. And yet, they want us to believe that they do. Go figure. Next page. We're still post-Reformation. Now, we're going to have an entire paragraph here for the Enlightenment. I know some of you think it's not even worth a sentence. Others think we should spend an entire course on it. But the Enlightenment, which many of you have heard me refer to as the Endarkenment, the Enlightenment basically was humanism co-opting the Reformation. I want you to think about that. Co-opting means stealing, taking away. Basically, what the Enlightenment did is they didn't really develop any new theories of interpretation. There were some things that were going on where Homer's works were being reinterpreted in a way and so forth. But basically, what the Enlightenment did was they supplied a new paradigm, a new Weltanschauung, a new way of looking at things. You all know what a Weltanschauung is?
A worldview,
a way, you know, take it apart. Weltanschauung, a way of looking at the world, a way of seeing the world. It's a world and life view. It's a way of looking at the world which crept into biblical studies. And basically, what the Enlightenment does is it's a denial of the supernatural. Alexander Pope's dictum, the measure of man, yeah, man is the measure of all things. The measure of man is man. Mm-hmm. Man is the measure of all things. So that's the idea behind humanism. Now, Lessing's Ugly Ditch, G.H. Lessing, that's an important name in the history of thought, but not necessarily in the history of hermeneutics, so I don't have him bold-faced on the slide. But basically what he spoke of was an ugly ditch between history and truth. He was saying that truth is one thing, history is another. You can't look at history to find truth. Unfortunately, he never really did tell us what we have to look at to find truth. It's kind of like someone characterized modernism. Well, we'll get to that when we get to the quest for the historical Jesus. But this idea of the ugly ditch between history and truth was later picked up by Francis Schaeffer, who characterized it as the line of despair. How many of you have read some Francis Schaeffer in your life? You know what he means by the line of despair, where you make the distinction between nature and grace or history and truth? and that there's no going beyond that line of despair. You can't get from nature to grace. You can't get from history to truth. That's the same thing that Lessing means by the ugly ditch. And of course, what Schaeffer is doing is he's criticizing modern philosophy for its inability to do that. Should we expect philosophy to be able to do that? No. So what do we have to rely upon?
Revelation.
Yeah. That's what Schaeffer would say, is because of that line of despair, God reaches through the line of despair and gives us revelation. So what is the key contribution, if you want to call it a contribution? It's more like taking away of the Enlightenment to biblical studies. It's this, that no longer is the Bible looked upon as a sacred book. It's now looked upon as a religious book. Can you make that distinction with me? What do we mean by sacred book and religious book? Well, when we talk about a religious book, we're putting it in the same category with the Quran, with the Indian holy writings and so forth. But when we refer to it as a sacred book, we're referring to it as something that God directly inspired. It's not just one religious book among many. Another, Mark, you and I have talked about this in the past. Another aspect of this Enlightenment thinking is that the study of Scripture moved out of the sanctuary into the academy, or it moved out of the ecclesiastical realm of control into the academic realm of control, or university realm of control. We're going to deal with a woman named Etta Lindemann, not today, hopefully either next meeting or the meeting after that, when we deal with the so-called synoptic problem. And what we're going to do is we're going to show how she completely... She begins with the concept that the university is not only not Christian in its origin, it's anti-Christian in its origin. It's interesting that she doesn't just take it back to the medieval scholastics, but that she takes it back to the pagans from which they got it. Remember, the medieval scholastics got the university from Aristotle. And basically what she complains about, and it's excellent reasoning, it's tight reasoning. What she complains about is the fact that the university has taken over biblical studies, and the university is pagan in its orientation. And that's basically what we see the Enlightenment doing. The Enlightenment moves biblical studies away from the church and into the academy. Or, if you will, away from ecclesiastical control into university control. So that now the key thing is not piety but scholarship. And how do we define scholarship? Well, by looking at which letters are after our name. Yeah. How do we decide before? Because how should it still be decided? As the presbytery examines a man who's being admitted to the presbytery, they examine him not only for his abilities, but for his views as well, right? That is the control that we have over people and how they teach. But now, what happens, how many of you have been to a presbytery meeting? How many of you have ever seen a reasonable, well, of course, I know you have because you've been to our presbytery meeting and you've undergone some of the grilling. But if you go to a presbytery meeting today, if a person has a seminary degree, there is almost no examination at all. Also, if he doesn't have a seminary degree, there's almost no examination at all because he's not allowed on the floor. But the point is that the church, even the Presbyterian church, has turned over the training of its ministry to the university. Although we call it the seminary, most seminaries are not under the control of the church. Most seminaries are either independent, well, they're just independent, or they're associated in some way with a secular university, like Chicago Divinity School, Yale Divinity School, Harvard Divinity School, and so on. Next. J.J. Griesbach. 1745 to 1812. He's transitional. He's what we might call, have y'all heard of the phrase, the term postmodern? We might characterize Griesbach as premodern. He's transitional between post-Reformation and modern. He developed a number of terms that continue in use till today. For example, the various text families of manuscripts. He was the one who originated the terms Alexandrian Western and Constantinopolitan. Nowadays we call the Constantinopolitan Byzantine. The idea of families of manuscripts was already there. He also coined the term synoptic with reference to the Gospels. You all know what the synoptic Gospels are? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And we see during his lifetime and during, in fact, the reason that he developed the term synoptic was so that he could bring out the so-called synoptic problem. We will deal with the synoptic problem, but we'll deal with it in a positive light. We're not going to present the problem without finding the solution. So I want to wait until we get to the end of the 19th century before we deal with the synoptic problem. And then the last, which we'll deal later in this course of studies. How many of you have ever heard of the synoptic problem? You have some idea. How many of you have no idea what I'm talking about? The synoptic problem basically asks two questions. Why are the synoptic gospels so much alike and why are they so different? When you think of it that way, the problem kind of goes away, doesn't it? But those are the two questions that they're asking. Why are they so much alike and why are they so different? And the reason that they claim that they're so much alike is that they were all plagiarists of either Mark or some character named Q. And the reason that they're so different is because they didn't have enough sense to copy each other very well. When you think of it that way, the problem kind of goes away. But you have to remember that this problem hides itself behind a mask of obfuscation. You know what obfuscation is? Never speak clearly when obfuscation will work. Obfuscation means that you just kick up a lot of dust and hope some of it sticks. Obfuscation, making things as unclear as possible. Next slide. Okay, 19th century. Do we have time? How much tape do we have? About 20 minutes. Okay, let's do the 19th century. Alexander Geddes. As far as I know, he's no relation to Jenny Geddes. Some of you are giving me funny looks. Do you all know who Jenny Geddes was? Does anybody know who Jenny Geddes was? How many of you read the Blue Banner? How many of you don't even know why I asked that? Who was Jenny Geddes? Yeah, if I had a milk stool here, I'd throw it at you for not knowing. Jenny Geddes was the lady who threw, the woman who threw her milk stool in 1637, July, Lord's Day in July, 1637. Well, as far as I know, he's no relation. 100 years later, he was born. Alexander Geddes, 1737 to 1802, proposed what he called a fragmentary hypothesis for the composition of the Pentateuch. How many of you have ever heard of that? You have some idea what we're talking about a fragmentary hypothesis. Well, basically what he was saying with the fragmentary hypothesis is that, you know, that Moses didn't just sit down and write the first five books of the Bible. What happened is over a long period of time, various fragments were done by different groups that had different agenda, and that eventually somebody, maybe Ezra, maybe somebody else, took all these things, took a razor blade and a jar of paste, and put them all together. That's the fragmentary hypothesis. Later on, it will become known as the Graf-Wellhausen theory, but it was first proposed by a man named Alexander Geddes. This theory was later elaborated by Vater, or Vater, if you will, and De Wet, who lived until 1849. De Wet based his suppositions primarily on Deuteronomy 12:5 and following. You remember Deuteronomy 12:5 is the one who says, you know, don't be worshiping God anywhere you want to. Worship Him in the central sanctuary. De Wet takes that as the takeoff point that this is the turning point for Deuteronomy. This is why the Pentateuch now began to be codified, is because the priestly element is wanting to make worship take place only at the temple, only at the central sanctuary. Again, we have to remember now, we're in the Enlightenment here. There's a denial of the supernatural. There's a denial of inspiration. So these things all have to be explained in what kind of terms? Natural terms. If it's not natural, it's not explainable. Okay, next slide. F.D.E. Schleiermacher, or Schleiermacher, a famous German, began the whole series of books that were written by numerous German rationalists called Life of Christ. Bishop Farrar wrote one in English, The Life of Christ. Leben Jesu was published posthumously, basically from notes, from lectures that he gave.
Farrar is liberal?
Pardon me?
Farrar is liberal?
I would regard Farrar as on the liberal side of center, yes. Mm-hmm. Schleiermacher, based on Papias was a church father. Papias believed that the book of Matthew had originally been written in Hebrew or Aramaic. And some people who want to maintain that there was a Hebrew Matthew still point to that section in Papias or Papias. And basically what Schleiermacher was saying was that there was originally, all you really had originally was the sayings of Jesus. And these were later elaborated upon by 2nd and 3rd and 4th century Christians to become what were then the Gospels. But the Gospels were not written by eyewitnesses. And in Schleiermacher we see the foundation of what will come to be known as modernism or liberalism, what you've heard me refer to in the past as German rationalism. Basically, it's a denial of the supernatural, and he was followed by many who emulated his presuppositions, and it's what eventually infected the mainline denominations in this country. Was there a question? Did I see a hand about to go up? Okay. Schleiermacher, 1834. Okay. Princeton. We're going to really jump over Princeton quickly, but Princeton is really key. And it's key primarily because of two men, Charles Hodge and Joseph Addison Alexander, or J.A. Alexander. And the reason that they're key is because of their approach in their commentaries. In their commentaries, Hodge wrote commentaries on Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and Ephesians. And if my memory serves, I think all four of those are still in print. Does anybody know for sure if all four of those are still in print? I think Banner of Truth has been good about keeping those in print. And J.A. Alexander did a commentary on Psalms, and he also did one on Acts and Mark, separate commentaries on Acts and Mark. Although his forte, his strong point, his strong area was not in Greek, but in Oriental languages. The man was a genius. He was a linguistic genius. He could sit down, open a book, close the book, and know the language. He was able simply to take an Oriental language, see how the language was constructed by reading in that language, and with the exception of vocabulary, of course, he'd have to memorize vocabulary, he knew the language. The man was a genius. He was a what is that called, a savant? Where a person has a genius in a particular area, he was just abs. And of course, you know whose son he was. Yeah, he was Archibald Alexander's son. And as you can see, he didn't live long. He lived to be 50 or 51 years old. But the key thing about Princeton, of course, there is the Princeton theology, and I'm not trying to minimize that, but we're doing a course in hermeneutics. And the key thing about Princeton for our hermeneutics course is their method of interpretation. And basically, they took a very plain language approach to interpretation. They were the development of all the things we saw in Reformation and post-Reformation, where we saw the author's intent, discourse analysis, linguistic considerations, historical considerations, contextual considerations, all brought together. So if you were to get a commentary by Alexander or Hodge, you would find basically the fruit of all of the Reformed thinking up to that point, as far as hermeneutics. And by the way, if you're going to go out and buy a commentary on Romans, buy Hodge, not Haldane. Not that Haldane is bad, except on chapter 6. And Haldane is so bad on chapter 6, just skip over Haldane and get Hodge.
Brown
is good. Murray is good. I wouldn't complain about. And I believe Murray is in print. I believe Hodge is in print. Haldane pretty much stays in print. Brown of Wamfrey. Is it Brown of Wamfrey? Is that who we're talking about? Or Brown of Edinburgh? Brown of Edinburgh. Edinburgh. Yeah, I think that pretty much stays in print also. Or am I thinking of David Brown as in Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown? I may be thinking of David Brown. But again, for 19th century, it's hard to beat Hodge on Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and Ephesians, or Alexander on Acts and Mark. And quite honestly, I've used Hodge rather extensively in my morning sermons on 1 Corinthians 13, the cessation of the charismata, and 1 Corinthians 14, which we haven't gotten to yet, but we will be as of next week. In fact, the slides are already made. It's just a question of mounting them and bringing them in. Next slide. The Tübingen School. this is supposed to have an umlaut over the U. I'm simply too lazy to put it there. You know what an umlaut is? That's those two dots. It looks like a lazy colon. Not a lazy colon, but a lazy. F.C. Bauer believed that there was a tension between Pauline and Petrine theologies. What does Petrine mean?
Peter.
Relating to Peter. And Pauline means relating to Paul. He believed that there was a tension between Pauline and Petrine theologies, which formed a key to understanding much of the New Testament. The idea behind the Pauline, his understanding, and I think it's a misunderstanding of Paul, is let's cast out the Old Testament and just go with grace, whereas the Petrine was let's cling to the Old Testament and go with law. Well, yeah, if that tension existed, that'd be quite a tension, wouldn't it? But he assumes it, and here's how the reasoning becomes. Or circular, what he does is anything that doesn't go along with that supposed tension, he just pushes it off to the second century and says, oh, well, that was written well after the tension was resolved. Right, so basically, he's free to ignore anything that doesn't fit his theory. But nevertheless, the Tübingen school in the 19th century became very, very important, and this whole idea of a tension existing between a Pauline and a Petrine theology still is taught by Hebrew divinity schools. So, for example, if you were going to divinity school to become a rabbi, you basically would study the Tübingen theory of the New Testament. Now you say, well, what possible reason do the rabbis have for studying the New Testament? Well, for the same reason that pastors have for knowing about the Book of Mormon. In other words, to refute it. This is the same theory that's still taught at Hebrew Divinity School. Hebrew School in Cincinnati, for example, teaches this theory. And this caused him to move much of the dating of the New Testament into the second century. However, Joseph Barber Lightfoot, I think, refuted that, and we're going to get to him in just a moment. Next slide. Benjamin Jowett. Wrote an article called On the Interpretation of Scripture in a series of essays that was published in 1860 called, by the original name, Essays and Reviews. And I want to cover what is good about what he said, but we also need to be careful about him because he opened the door to liberalism, to doubt, and to basically cynicism and scholasticism in a bad way. What he warned us against was reading in our opinions when we see certain words or phrases. So that, for example, we have a whole complex of thinking that surrounds, I'm just going to give you one example, that surrounds the word divorce. Okay? We have a whole complex of thinking that goes with that. Okay? What he warns us against is when we go to the Bible and see the word divorce, that we don't read everything that we think about divorce back into that word. That's just one example. You know, he would speak of numerous examples. You've heard me say something very similar to that, haven't you? We need to be careful that we let the Scripture define a word and that we don't bring our definitions to the word. Well, that's what's positive about him. What's negative about him is he basically insists that you come to the Scriptures empty-headed. And so he does away with any possibility of presupposition. We're going to talk, in fact, as soon as we finish up the historical survey, we're going to talk the very next thing about what propositions should we bring to Scripture with us. Are there certain presuppositions that we must have in order to understand Scripture? However, Jowett's approach led as much to doubt as to inquiry. He would say, well, if you try to shut out inquiry at the door, doubt will come in the window. That's a famous phrase of his. But the fact of it is, he had no way of distinguishing between inquiry and doubt. And he let in as much doubt as, well, in fact, even really to the point of cynicism. Next page. Is this our last page?
Yes, sir.
Great. How much time do we have left? We have 10 minutes, 5 minutes? About eight. All right. Well, I hit in between somewhere. Okay. Last slide. What we might refer to as the Cambridge School or the Cambridge Three. And the Cambridge Three, two of them, and you can, you know, during Purim, whenever the Jewish children see the or hear read the story of Mordecai and Esther and so forth, whenever Haman is mentioned, they all go boo like that. Whenever Haman is mentioned. So now, whenever we say Westcott and Hort, what is your response? Actually, Westcott and Hort made some valuable contributions. However, what they did was they put together a text called the Westcott and Hort text, which is a significant variation from the received text of the Reformation, the received Greek text of the Reformation, and virtually all modern translations are based on really some variation of the Westcott and Hort. If you look at the fourth edition of the UBS, if you were to do a compilation, there are very, very few differences between. In fact, there are more differences between Erasmus's first edition and his last edition than there are between the UBS fourth edition and the Westcott and Hort edition. So basically the Westcott and Hort text of the 1880s is the modern text. And I'll tell you something else. Anytime B, which is Vaticanus, anytime Vaticanus and P75 agree, you can count on that being the modern text. Anyway, B.F. Westcott, F.J.A. Hort, and J.B. Lightfoot are the three men that you might think of as the Cambridge Three or the Cambridge School. And Westcott and Hort we'll skip over because we know who they were. They were commentators. They did a number of commentaries. They did very tight, original intent type of commentaries. J.B. Lightfoot, his main contribution to New Testament studies was not in the New Testament. His main contribution to New Testament studies was in the Apostolic Fathers. And the thing that makes the Apostolic Fathers important is he pushes the Apostolic Fathers back to roughly 90 to 100 A.D. Well, now, if the Apostolic Fathers are dated 90 to 100 A.D., and if they're quoting the New Testament, then when must the New Testament have been written? Prior to that. So what he does by pushing the Apostolic Fathers back to 90 to 100 A.D. is he pushes the New Testament back into the first century. The dating of the New Testament back into the first century. Okay, we may have 1 or 2 minutes left. Are there any questions? Looks like the only question is how do we get out of here?
A lot of what you're bringing up is, I'm trying to accentuate
responds, but also makes us familiar with where people might read in their interpretation might come from?
Well, there are a number of people that we didn't deal with. I mean, we could have multiplied a lot of names through the 19th century and post-Reformation period. For example, I think we could have brought in the Westminster Confession of Faith that has some important things to say, but we talked about that kind of in our introduction. We could have brought in Turretin, who was a scholastic, post-Reformation scholastic in Geneva, who had some important work that he did. We could bring out the fact that much of the post-Reformation work that was done, the interpretive work, was done from a polemic standpoint. In other words, how do I use the scriptures to prove my position? Proof texting began about that time. So there are a number of things that we moved over that we didn't touch on, a number of things that we touched on that we could have done in a lot more depth than we did. The reason for text criticism is not because we think that everything that's ever been said by anybody about text criticism is correct, but because text criticism is a reality. We have to deal with it. If we're going to read Calvin's commentaries, Calvin sometimes says, well, here's what some of the manuscripts say, and here's what other manuscripts say, and here's what I believe it says. You know, well, what's he doing? He's basically comparing manuscript with manuscript, and that is the work of text criticism. So we don't throw text criticism out the window. We do say, however, that there was a text that was common to the Reformation, and we believe that the burden of proof is weighty for anybody who would move away from that text.
So what's the line? If you're going to say the burden of proof, you're assuming that there is...
Assuming that there is a criterion of proof. Yeah, basically, I think that at this point the line has to be just virtual certainty. I'll give you some examples when the camera's not running. Don't want to be incriminated. That's right. The camera's not running. Okay, we're done.